Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. The Sleep by Caitlin Horrocks. The snow came early that first year, and so heavy that when Albert Rasmussen invited the whole town over, we had to park around the corner from his unplowed street. We staggered through the drifts, across the lawns, down the neat sidewalks where a few of Al's neighbors owned snowblowers. Mr. Kajimaki and the Lutfen boys were still out huffing and puffing with shovels. We waved as we passed, and they nodded. Al stood that November in his family room, arms outstretched, knee-deep in a nest of mattresses and bedding, flannels and florals mixed with Bobby Rasmussen's NASCAR pillowcases, Dee's Disney Princess comforter. The sideboard had a hot plate and an electric kettle plugged into a power strip. Al opened drawers filled with crackers, tinned soup, bags of pink frosted animal cookies, vitamin C pills, and canned juice to prevent scurvy. Hibernation, he announced. Human hibernation. This was before the cameras, before the sleep, before the outsiders, and the plan sounded as strange to us then as it would to anybody. Our town had always wintered the way towns do, gas bills and window plastic, blankets and boots. We bought cream for our cracked skin and socks for our numb feet. We knew how we felt when our extremities faded temporarily away, and we knew how much we hurt when they prickled back to life. Al showed off a heater he'd built that ran on used grease, and the filter that sieved out the hash browns and hamburger. Al had always been handy. He'd been the smartest kid in school, back when Bounty still had its own high school. He was a senior everyone called college material until he decided to stay, and then we called him ours. Our Albert, Albert and his girl Jeannie, who were confident that everything they could want in the world was right here in Bounty. We went to their wedding the Saturday after graduation and then stood by, helpless, when Albert's parents lost the farm 3 years later. Maybe the family should have gotten out then, moved away and never looked back. Al might have found a job that paid better than fence repair, and Jeannie might not have been killed by Reggie Lapham, 17 years old and driving drunk on Highway 51, 8 months before Al's November invitation. Al might never have struck on hibernation, and we might all have gone along the way we'd been going for better or worse. But they had stayed, and Jeannie had died, and Reggie had been sent to a juvenile detention facility downstate. The accident happened in early spring, when patches of snow were still dissolving on the roads, and what no one would say within Al's earshot was that the weather had killed her as much as Reggie had. Al needed something small enough to blame, and Reggie, skinny as a weed and driving his father's truck, served as well as anything could. Al had always seemed older than he was, had transitioned easily from high school basketball star to assistant coach. Now in his 30s, he looked 20 years older, bent and exhausted. We wondered if the weight on his shoulders was truly Jeannie, or if he'd been carrying, for more years than we'd realized, some piece of Bounty, and he'd invited us over to make sure we understood that he was putting it down. We'd all stayed in Bounty the way Al had stayed, had carried it as best we could. When our high school shut down, we sent our children to the next town over, then to the county consolidated when that one closed too. They came home with their textbooks about westward expansion, about the gold rush, the tin rush, the copper rush, the wheat farms, the corn farms, the feedlots, about land that gave until it couldn't give, and the chumps who kept trying to live on it. Our children came home and told us that we were the suckers of the last century. But what if you love it here? We asked them. What if you don't want to leave? What's to love? Our children asked in surly disbelief. What kind of morons hustle for jobs that don't even pay for cable television? What kind of people spend 20 years buying beer at the Hop Inn and drinking in the quarry, the next 30 drinking at the Points and the last sudden 10 at the Elks Lodge? Our kind of people, we thought. Sleep, Al said, there in his living room, and explained how in the old days in Russia people sacked out around a stove when the snows came, waking to munch a piece of rye bread, feed the fire, slump back into sleep.
Only so much food could be laid in, and the thinking went that unless a man could come up with something to do in the cold and the dark that justified the calories he'd expend doing it, he was better off doing nothing. The Russians would wake up skinny and hungry, but they'd wake up alive. We worried that maybe the Rasmussens were harder up than we had thought. Times were tough for everybody, but others weren't shutting down their houses and lives and planning to warm their kids with burger grease. "What do we do all winter?" Al asked, the kind of question we knew he considered rhetorical. "Why work like dogs all summer to keep the television on, the furnace cranked, noodles on the stove? Why scrape off the car to burn fuel to go to the store to buy more noodles? That's pointless." Mrs. Pakola of Pakola Downtown Antiques opened her mouth for a moment, as if she were going to point out that the routine wasn't much different from plenty of people's autumns and springs and maybe summers, in which case Al was saying that we might as well all blow our brains out and have done with it. But she stayed silent, probably because she thought of many things we didn't need to hear. "What about Christmas?" Mrs. Drausman, the librarian, offered. "We're staying awake for it, just doing a 2-month trial run this year, January and February," Al explained. "School," Bill and Valier Simmons said. "Your kids." Al shrugged. Both his kids were bright and ahead of their classes. At 7, Dee read at a 6th grade level. Bobby was 9 and the best speller at Bounty Elementary. Al had picked up copies of the upcoming curriculum, long division, suffixes, photosynthesis, cursive. "We're having a sleepover instead," Dee said. "You know what Mrs. Fisk has planned for February?" "Fractions," Bobby yelled, and the kids bopped around the room until Al chased them upstairs. "They'll get caught up in spring," Al said. "I don't think they'll have difficulty." He looked around at us, his old compatriots, the parents of the handful of children still enrolled at the school, and apologized. "I didn't mean anything by that," he said. "I don't think they're special, but they probably won't miss much." We nodded. Being the children of a dying town had taught us that none of us was special. Whatever our various talents, we'd all ended up here, in the Rasmussen's family room. "Don't try to convince me anything worthwhile happens in this town during January and February. I've lived here as long as you have," Al said. We could tell he meant to joke, but nobody laughed. "I'm not crazy. NASA studies this stuff. They're planning for astronauts to hibernate through long voyages, so they don't go stir-crazy and kill each other. Bust out the shuttle walls." Al's fingers twitched a bit, and we looked at his walls. Scuffed beige paint, 3 china plates with pictures of Holsteins, a family portrait taken at the J.C. Penney and Bullhorn when Jeannie was still alive, and a single round hole at the height of a man's fist, sloppily covered with paint and plaster. His walls looked a lot like our walls, and all of a sudden we were tempted to jam our fists in and pull them down. "You think we're like that?" Niels Anderson asked from the back of the crowd, all the way in the front foyer, and people parted to let him come closer. He'd been a point guard to Al's shooting guard on the old high school basketball team. The two still sometimes took practice shots into the hoop on Al's garage. "Like what?" "Russians and astronauts. You think we've got 2 options, asleep or dead?" Al started to shake his head, because we're not a town that likes to offend. Then he paused, ran his big hands through his hair, and let them drop to his sides. Fair and broad and tall, like his parents and grandparents and Norwegian great-grandparents, like a lot of the rest of us, he looked suddenly large and unwieldy, as if he could only ever fit in this little room curled up asleep, and we'd all been crazy to hope otherwise. He hunched his shoulders and looked down at the floor. "Maybe," he said, "this is about my family. I never meant any of you had to be involved, but maybe." We thought our town's silence had been stoic. We glimpsed now how much we simply hadn't wanted to say. We rustled in the blankets but kept our mouths shut, put on our shoes, and drifted out into the snow. Some of us drove straight home. Others took longer routes down Main Street, past First Lutheran, the Points, the Elks Lodge, Mrs. Pakola's antique store, the single-screen movie theater with a marquee still announcing closed, as if the closing were news. The public library was housed in the old pharmacy. We checked out our books at the prescriptions counter and bought our prescriptions 30 miles down the road. We looked at all the shuttered stores and tried to remember what each one had sold. We cruised back and forth like bored teenagers on Saturday nights, watching the road run quickly from empty storefronts to clapboard frame houses and tiny brick ranches. We turned around at the hop bin at the west end of town, near the park with its silent gray bandstand. We drove east until we passed the elementary school and empty high school, then turned into the parking lot of the old farm supply store, the beams of its collapsed roof poking skyward in its windows like eyes. Bounty had never been a pretty town, but we'd tried to be proud of it. Now we examined it carefully, looking for new reasons to stay awake. One by one we gave up, peeled off, and drove home. We turned into our shoveled driveways in the tiny grid of residential streets, or took spokes of blacktop and gravel out to scattered farmhouses and little islands of yard, their old acreage spreading behind them like a taunt. Bounty was an assertion, an act of faith. It looked best left unexamined. A few of us met back at the points that night for beer and darts. The hours went by, but no one said a thing about Al Rasmussen, and we were all waiting for it. "Fucking Greece," Niels finally said. "Like fucking Russians." We were able to laugh then and walk out to the parking lot, slapping each other's backs and leaving trails of footprints in the snow. We felt better about ourselves, sitting side by side in our idling cars, waiting for the engines to warm. On New Year's Day, the Rasmussens made neighborhood rounds, dropping off house keys and perishables, a gallon of milk and some apples for the Lutfen boys, carrots for Valier Simmons, a bag of shredded cheese, and half a loaf of bread for Mr. Kajimaki. We wished them luck and hung the keys on pegs. We could have robbed them blind while they slept, but we knew they didn't have anything worth taking. We tiptoed in ones and twos to watch the family sleep, to see how this hibernation thing was working out. The kids looked peaceful. The food disappeared in barely perceptible increments. The room was stuffy by late February, smelling of night sweat and canned soup, but the Rasmussens didn't seem to mind. Mrs. Bacola lit a lavender-scented candle on the sideboard and found it blown out the next day. All in all, they looked cozy. In March, the children woke first, bounding out the front door in their pajamas. Spring hadn't really started yet. Dirty snow was still melting into mud. But the fiercest part of winter was over. Al looked rested for the first time since Jeannie's death, the terrible tension gone from his shoulders. His body looked more like that of a man most of us had known for years, but his eyes looked like a stranger's. No one could place the expression, except those of us whose children or grandchildren had left Bounty, gone off for college or work. When the children came back, we said, their eyes looked like that, like departure. Imagine, we thought, Albert had found that look in his sleep. He asked for all the updates. A blizzard in early February had blown the roof off of the old hardware store. Mr. Fisk had had a heart attack one morning in the barn with his livestock. One of the grain elevator operators had died of cirrhosis, and half the town had applied for his job. The youngest Suarez boy had tried to hitch home from work at the rendering plant in Pyrrhic one evening, but nobody stopped. He decided to walk and disappeared into the snow. We drove poles down, walking across the fields in formation, bracing ourselves to strike flesh. We never found him. Now that spring had come, we probably would. "Anything good?" Al asked. We struggled. We hadn't thought about how dark the winter had been when we were in its midst. "One of the Tau girls had a baby," we said. Al smiled, although half the town thought the Taus belonged to us and half wanted nothing to do with them. "That's something." "What did you do?" we asked, and before he could say, "I slept," we specified. "What was it like? How did it feel?" "I had these long dreams," he said, "unfolding over days. I dreamed I was in Eden, but it was mine, my farm. I picked pineapples every day." Al Rasmussen had wintered in Eden, we thought. We started to feel a little like suckers. Bobby and Dee had boundless energy and spent a lot of it recounting dreams to their schoolmates. Soon many of the children were planning for their own long sleep, and the ones who weren't were calculating how scary empty classrooms might get, how the forest of raised hands would thin and they'd get called on over and over, expected to know the right answers. They pictured how lonely the playground would be, all lopsided seesaws and unpushed swings, and soon all of the children of Bounty were begging to spend the next winter asleep. Quite a few of them got their way. The Lutfen boys were happy not to catch the bus in the dark, standing around in 20 below. The pudgy Sanderson girl, all bushy hair and braces, woke up with her teeth straighter and her belly flat. She showed off her new smile for Lucy Simmons, and Lucy confessed that her period had started sometime in early February. How easily, they thought, so much of the hard work of growing up had happened while they were asleep, while no one could make fun of them for it. Mrs. Sanderson fit into clothes she hadn't worn since high school. The styles had changed, but she paraded around in her high-waisted, acid-washed jeans, just so we could admire what sleep had done for her. Mr. Sanderson had started off awake, reporting to the John Deere dealership north of town at 9 every morning the way he'd done for years. But suddenly he saw the unfairness, his creaking out of bed while his wife rolled over with a slack, content smile. "Our food costs were way down," he said at the points one night the next spring. "The heat bills, gas. For once my daughter wasn't pestering for a new pair of jeans. I asked for a temporary leave. They said sales were down so far I'd be doing them a favor. A lot of us lived in houses our parents or grandparents had owned. Mortgages weren't usually our problem. Just the daily costs of living, and the closer those got to zero, the less we needed to work. John Deere lost 3 more before the winter was over. Other folks didn't have any employers to apologize to. The families that still kept animals thought we were all a bunch of pansies, at least according to Nils, but then we imagine him slogging to the barn every morning at 5 for the feeding and the milking, his fingers stiff and snot frozen in his mustache, and we mostly just felt smart. Mrs. Drausman, the town librarian, hated the sleep even more than Nils. She cornered Bobby and Dee after story time near the shelves that once held skin creams and now held paperbacks and threatened, "This will be like Narnia under the White Witch, always winter and never Christmas." "After Christmas," Dee asked her, "what's there to like? What do you do?" "I keep the library open," she said, "so everyone has books. They come and use the computers and get their music and their movies." "If you're dreaming, you have your own movies," Dee said gravely, and Mrs. Drausman sighed. We tried to make it up to her, registered for her summer reading program, and attended fall story time. But Dee was right. Sleeping folk needed almost nothing, a little food, a little water, air, and warmth. They definitely didn't need DVDs. That second winter, the road crews noticed less traffic, and some of the plow drivers' hours were cut. Several decided to screw it and just sleep, and by the time the county and the drivers were done sniping at each other, the budget for next year's salting and plowing was half what it had been. The harder leaving your driveway was, the easier the choice to stay home. The third year, a family died of carbon monoxide poisoning from an unventilated gas heater. An electric space heater started a fire at the Simmonses. They got out, but the house was a loss. Al staggered into the snow, bleary-eyed, called his neighbors dumbasses, and then invited them to pile on into his family room. When he woke up for real in March, he announced that if we were all going to do this thing, we should do it right. He didn't have enough old grease for everyone, so he charged hourly for consultations about different compact heating systems, then for assembly and installation, and soon he was doing well enough to quit fence repair. We were glad Al had the new business because that October, Reggie Lapham came home. He'd been 17 when he hit Jeannie 3.5 years earlier, and as young as that was, as much as we remembered the ice on the road and the evenings we'd gotten behind the wheel when we shouldn't have, we weren't sure how to forgive him. Our hearts went out to Reggie, and then to Jeannie, and then to Al and Bobby and Dee, and then back to Reggie, until we couldn't keep our hearts straight and peaceful in our own chests. They were all ours, and we were too much like all of them. We needed men like Al to lead us, and we needed young people like Reggie to stay. We looked to Al for permission to take Reggie back. But Reggie seemed to know Al wasn't going to give it, at least not that autumn, because he walked from his parents' van into his house and wouldn't come out again. We spoke to Mrs. Lappin at the Hop Inn. "He's looking forward to the sleep," she said. "That's really all he wants to do. I don't think he would have come back if he had to." She broke off, and we wondered, had to what? Leave the house? Talk to people? Get a job? The family went to bed a few days after Thanksgiving. Mrs. Lappin said that seemed like the easiest way to get through what had to be gotten through. Then we heard that Al had put his kids to bed early, too, without Christmas, and then some of us started calculating the money we could save not buying presents. Those of us without small children, or without extended families, had to admit that the holidays were a downer as often as not. We knew that the Laphams and the Rasmussens weren't sleeping for the healthiest of reasons, but we understood the urge. Mrs. Drausman called in to a radio psychologist when everyone woke up the next spring about whether sleeping through 4 months of strife was sanity or just denial. She talked her way past the producers, but Dr. Joe wouldn't believe her. "Sure, excessive sleeping is a sign of depression," he said, "but no one hibernates." Then he hung up. Several of us heard the call, and it prompted some soul-searching, both about why so many of us were listening to the Dr. Joe show and about what our town might look like to outsiders. We started to wonder if Reggie Lapham should maybe be talking to somebody. If Al and Reggie needed help, we weren't giving it to them because sleeping was easier for us, too. A woman from the Pyrrhic Gazette heard the Dr. Joe show that night and came to ask Mrs. Drausman some questions. We braced ourselves for the story, but the reporter apparently couldn't figure out whom to believe or what the heck was going on, and before she hit on the answer, the Gannett Company shut down the paper. We saw Nils Anderson and Al having a beer together at the Points a few weeks later, the first time they'd been social together in years. "She came to interview me," Nils said. "I told her the hibernation business was bullshit." "I know you think the sleeping's bullshit," Al said. "You don't need to tell me." "I told her Drausman was bullshit. I told her nothing was going on in this town that was any of Dr. Joe's business or the Pyrrhic Gazette's. I told her to leave you alone." Nils shook his head and clinked the neck of his bottle against Al's. "I figured you've always known what you needed. Crazy fucker." A few weeks later, we watched the grease heater leave the Rasmussen house in parts. The foam-taped exhaust pipe, the burger filter. The mattresses came out. Bobby's and Dee's sheets graduated now from NASCAR and Disney to plain solids, navy and lavender. We worried Al was abandoning the cause until we found out he'd reassembled it all at the Anderson farm. With more people to share shifts taking care of the animals, Al explained, everyone could get some sleep. More people economized like this, throwing in their lots with friends, neighbors. The Simmonses rebuilt their burned house with a single large room on the ground floor, an energy-efficient heat stove in the center, with non-flammable tile around the base. They went to ask Al's permission and then invited the Laphams to spend the next winter. They knew what a chill felt like, they said, as well as to be given shelter when nothing but cold was around you. Mrs. Drausman stayed awake. She had her books. She had her own kind of dreaming. She and Mrs. Bacola would walk up and down the streets, Mrs. Drausman's snow boots and Mrs. Bacola's orthopedics the only prints for miles. Mrs. Bacola's faith wouldn't let her sleep. She walked to the Lutheran church every December 24th to light the Christ candle. "I'm sorry," she whispered to God. "They don't mean anything by it. They don't mean to disrespect you." She tried to tell us in spring how lonely our church looked, a single candle alight in the empty sanctuary. In the first years, the Reverend turned the electricity back on whenever the temperature hit 45, but then someone hit on the idea of Easter. We flipped the switch on the day that Christ rose. "Alleluia, Alleluia," we sang, uttering the word we had denied ourselves for Lent, one of the first words to pass our lips since waking. The Rasmussens and the Laphams stood in their old pews just across the aisle from each other. They didn't embrace at the greeting neighbors part of the service, didn't say, "Peace be with you," or, "and also with you," but they didn't flee. Al stood between his children with an arm draped over each of them, and we realized with surprise that Bobby was 14 now and nearly as tall as his father. He would have been good at basketball, too, if he'd been awake for the season. Dee's pale hair had darkened to a dirty blonde, and her face was spotted with acne. The kids leaned into their father, facing forward until Dee looked to her right and nodded at Mrs. Lapham. Just then, Reggie turned his head to peer anxiously over at his mother, and we saw Dee freeze and then slowly nodded him, too. We all nodded our pale faces at each other, and that seemed like enough. In the end, the hop-in is what brought the outsiders. Corporate couldn't understand why winter quarter sales were down 95% from 5 years earlier. A regional manager came out, and then his supervisors, and finally news crews from Fargo. The satellite vans were hard to miss, and we stayed up that night for the 11 o'clock news. We hadn't expected the story they chose to tell. It wasn't a human interest piece about ingenuity or survival. "Our hibernation practice was horrible," the anchors announced, from up and down the state, then across the country, horrifying, another product of the recession, a new economic indicator. In addition to tumbling home prices and soaring unemployment, a town was going to sleep. A blonde reporter asked the Sandersons if they were making a statement. "We get tired," they said. "Is that a statement?" We were annoyed at how they filmed the shabbiest parts of our town until we flipped through the newscasts and realized that together they'd filmed nearly all of our town and that it all looked equally shabby. We were used to our potholes and tumble-down barns, and now alongside those were cracked sidewalks and collapsing houses. The gray bandstand in the park leaned heavily to one side. The flat roof of the old high school had caved in under last year's snow. Raccoons and groundhogs hibernated in some of the downtown buildings and chased each other up and down Main Street in their spring excitement. A few had gotten into Mrs. Pecola's antique store, either for burrow bedding or just to be troublesome, and we were plagued by a video clip of skinny raccoons bursting out of the store's front door, trailing gnawed-up christening dresses and crib quilts. A badger birthed the spring litter in the church basement on a pile of old Sunday school workbooks. We told ourselves that none of this mattered. We weren't using the buildings anyway, the barns, the high school, most of downtown. We reminded ourselves that Bounty had never been a pretty place. It was built for function, not ornament, and as long as it functioned the way we wanted, we shouldn't be ashamed. We had never had any great architecture in Bounty, and the certainty that we never would didn't seem a sacrifice. We might have become a tourist attraction, except that getting to us when we were sleeping was so hard. The snow accumulated in giant drifts. We put a big stick out by the Welcome to Bounty sign and let it measure how deeply we were buried. People could come in on the highway, as far as the county plowed it, and then see a wall of snow taller than their car greeting them at the entrance. That was the establishing shot, a tiny car next to a wall of snow, when the documentary was released. On the 10th anniversary of the sleep, the state public television channel contacted us and said they planned to take a more balanced approach than the news crews. We liked that they promised to hold the premiere in Bounty, projected after dark onto the wall of the farm supply store since the old movie theater had been condemned. They interviewed Bobby in his dorm room in the last weeks of the fall semester. The state university had offered him a small baseball scholarship. He was a one-sport kid. "I'm not sure where I'll go for Christmas break," he said. "I haven't had Christmas in years. My dad and my sister won't even be awake." He was broad like his father, a young man there in his cramped college room, and we wondered if Jeannie would even have recognized him. The Lutfen boys had already finished college, worked for a year in St. Paul, and then come home. They liked the pace of life here, they said. They liked the way winter gave you a chance to catch your breath. One of them married the Sanderson girl who'd taken over the antique store and chased the raccoons out. Even after two Lutfen babies, 10-pound Scandinavian boys, she fit into the shop's old clothes, the slim-fitted dresses. She liked the quiet way her boys were growing up, she said, polite and calm and curled for 5 months like warm puppies at her side. Mrs. Pecola had passed away, which we knew, but we hadn't known her family blamed us. Her eldest daughter was living in Florida, and the filmmakers had gone down to interview her about how her mother had died alone in a church pew, frozen to death in a wool coat and orthopedic shoes. No one found her till spring, the woman said, her anger fresh and righteous. Mrs. Fisk had taught all the Pecola girls over the years. "Fractions," she whispered in the audience. "That girl just hated fractions." Dee had never left Bounty, never expressed any interest in going anywhere else. She was ours, like her father before her, despite her faraway look most days, her eyes the color of ice that froze over the flooded quarry. Her dirty blonde hair had darkened to brown, and her teenage acne had faded into a nearly translucent paleness. She volunteered at the library with Mrs. Drausman and took over story time. The film showing her sitting in a rocking chair with books far too advanced for the children gathered cross-legged around her. He heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead, she read, as the children squirmed. She wasn't very good at story time, but Mrs. Drausman had grown hoarse and weary over the years. One by one we tried to explain for the cameras. Why stay? What is Bounty worth? 3 months? 4? Half your life spent asleep? Our people had moved to Bounty because the land was there and it was empty, and now all we had was the emptiness and each other. We had a wide sky and tall grass and a sun that felt good when you waited for it half the year. We had our children, the ones we'd feared for, feared their boredom and their recklessness and their hunger for somewhere else. We feared becoming Jeannie Rasmussen, and we feared becoming Reggie Lapham. We feared wanting too much and ending up with less than what we already had. Now Al and Nils dreamed of the sound of a basketball bouncing off the warped, snow-soaked floor of the high school gymnasium. Al dreamed of nights asleep in Jeannie's arms. Reggie Lapham probably dreamed his life differently, too. But he seemed content with what he had. He was interviewed with his son on his lap, a boy who never made a snowman, never opened a Christmas present. He spoke about that first year back, about how the sleep had saved him, and when his voice foundered, his wife, Naujtau Thapam, reached over to squeeze his hand. Dr. Joe, interviewed, said that the sleep was profoundly unhealthy, that legislation should be passed before the custom could spread. The documentary included interviews with American history professors at the State University, experts on westward expansion, on what had happened to our country over the past two centuries. Someone in the bow tie said he was dismayed by what had happened to our immigrant spirit, to our desire to press on and out to something better. Our congressman pointed out that the immigrant spirit might have pushed us all the way on out of the state, further west or back east. Instead, we'd found a way to stay, and the census didn't ask if you were awake or asleep. It just asked where you lived, and now, more than ever, we were proud to say we lived in Bounty. Sisu, old Mr. Kajimaki, grunted for the camera with his hand held in front of his mouth. His teeth had fallen out, but he'd never bothered with dentures, and we felt a bit guilty that no one had insisted on driving him to Pyrrhic to get some fitted. Our people were shabby like our houses, our streets, our ancient coats and boots. But our ancestors had come, and they had stopped, and we persisted. Persistence, Mr. Kajimaki's old-world word for it. The endurance of a people who had once starved and eaten bark and come across an ocean to a flat sea of snow to make new ways of life when the old ones seemed insufficient. But do you regret their decision? Your father's? The interviewer off-camera prodded. The film cut back to Dee and Al standing together. They were outside, walking down the shuttered main street of our town, the sky blue and endlessly wide. Dee squinted in the light, and Al squinted at his daughter. He'd been quiet in front of the cameras, tentative to the point of taciturn, and as we watched the movie from lawn chairs in the farm supply store parking lot, we could see him fidgeting, turning his head to check the expression on his children's faces, turning around in his seat to look at the people he'd led into sleep. I barely remember what our life was like before. I remember being cold. And now? Dee looked baffled, not able to find words sufficient to explain half her life, the happier, more perfect half. The camera turned to Al, but his face was unreadable. Now? Dee said. Now I guess we're not. Now we are the people of Bounty, the farmers of dust and cold, the harvesters of dreams. After the lumber, after the mines, after the railroad, after the interstate, after the crops, after the cows, after the jobs. We're better neighbors in warm beds than we ever were awake. The suckers of the last century, but not of this one. And that story was Asleep by Caitlin Horrocks from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, La Vita Nuova by Allegra Goodman. The day her fiancé left, Amanda went walking in the colonial cemetery off Garden Street. The gravestones were so worn that she could hardly read them. They were melting away into the weedy grass. You are a very dark person, her fiancé had said. She walked home and sat in her half-empty closet. Her vintage 1950s wedding dress hung in clear, asphyxiating plastic printed, "Not a toy." She took the dress to work. She hooked the hanger onto a grab bar on the tee, and the dress rustled and swayed. When she got out at Harvard Square, the guy who played guitar near the turnstiles called, "Congratulations!" Work was at the Garden School, where Amanda taught art, including theater, puppets, storytelling, drumming, dance, and now fabric painting. She spread the white satin gown on the art room floor. Two girls glued pink feathers all along the hem. Others brushed the skirt with green and purple. A boy named Nathaniel dipped his hand in red paint and left his little handprint on the bodice as though the dress were an Indian pony. At lunchtime, the principal asked Amanda to step into her office. "You are like living with a dark cloud," Amanda's fiancé had told her when he left. "You're always sad." "I'm sad now," Amanda had said. The principal told Amanda that for an educator, boundaries were an issue. "Your personal life," said the principal, "is not an appropriate art project for first grade. Your classroom," said the principal, "is not an appropriate forum for your relationships. Let's pack up the wedding dress." "It's still wet," Amanda said. Her mother could not believe it. She had just sent out all the invitations. Her father swore he'd kill the son of a bitch. They both asked how this could have happened, but they remembered that they had had doubts all along. Her sister Lisa said she could not imagine what Amanda was going through. She must feel so terrible. Was Amanda going to have to write to everyone on the guest list? Like a card or something? She'd have to tell everybody, wouldn't she? "I waited all this time because I didn't want to hurt you," Amanda's fiancé had said. After school, she went for a drink with the old blonde gym teacher, Patsy. They went to a bar called Cambridge Common and ordered gin and tonics. Patsy said, "Eventually you're going to realize that this is a blessing in disguise." "We had too many differences," said Amanda. Patsy lifted her glass. "There you go. For example, I loved him and he didn't love me." "Don't be surprised," said Patsy, "if he immediately marries someone else. Guys like that immediately marry someone else." "Why?" Amanda asked. Patsy sighed. "If I knew that, I'd be teaching at Harvard, not teaching the professor's kids." Amanda tried writing a card or something. She wrote that she and her fiancé had decided not to marry. Then she wrote that her fiancé had decided not to marry her. She said that she was sorry for any inconvenience. She added that she would appreciate gifts anyway. Her parents told her not to send a card. They said that they were coming up for a week. She said that they couldn't come because she was painting her apartment. She did not paint the apartment. In the winter, Amanda cut her hair short like a boy's. "Oh, your hair," said Patsy, "your beautiful curls." In the spring, the principal told Amanda that regretfully she was not being renewed for the following year because the art program at the garden school was moving in a different direction. In the summer, Amanda's fiancé married someone else. When school ended, Amanda took a job babysitting Nathaniel, the boy with the red handprint. Nathaniel's mother asked for stimulating activities, projects, science, no TV. Nathaniel's father didn't ask for anything. Their first day together, Amanda asked Nathaniel, "What do you want to do?" "Nothing," she said. "You read my mind." They ate chocolate mice at Burdick's, and then they stood in front of the Harvard coop and listened to Peruvian musicians. They explored the cemetery, and Amanda told Nathaniel that the gravestones were dragon's teeth. They walked down to the river, and she said, "If you trace the river all the way to the beginning, you'll find a magic cave." They took the tea to Boston and stood in line for the swan boats in the public garden. She said, "At night, these boats turn into real swans." Nathaniel said, "You have a great imagination." His mother lived in a Victorian house on Buckingham Street. She worked at the media lab at MIT, and she had deadlines. The house had a garden full of flowers, but Nathaniel couldn't play there because you couldn't really dig. His father lived in an upside-down townhouse on Chauncey Street. The bedrooms were on the bottom floors and the kitchen and living room on top. His father was writing a book, and he came home late. Amanda and Nathaniel had pizza delivered to Chauncey Street and watched Charlie Chaplin movies from Hollywood Express. Sometimes they spread a sheet over the couch and ate a big bowl of popcorn. "It's hard to be with you," her fiancé had said. "I feel like I'm suffocating." "Open a window," Amanda had said. When the movie was done, Amanda gathered the sheet and stepped onto the balcony where she shook out the crumbs. Amanda and Nathaniel had playdates with his friends at Walden Pond. They went canoeing on the Charles, and Nathaniel dropped his paddle in the water. Amanda almost tipped the boat trying to fish it out. They wrote a book about pirates. Nathaniel told the stories, and Amanda typed them on the computer in his father's study. "Arr, matey," she typed. "I'm stuck on a ship." When his father stayed out past Nathaniel's bedtime, Amanda tucked Nathaniel in, and then she read books in the study. The books were about American history. She read only a few pages of each, so she didn't learn anything. If you ever stopped to listen, her fiancé had said, then you would understand. She stood on a chair and pulled out some small paperbacks from the top shelf. Dante, the Divine Comedy, in a new translation. Boccaccio, the Decameron. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, complete and unabridged. Dante again, La Vita Nuova. La Vita Nuova explained how to become a great poet. The secret was to fall in love with the perfect girl, but never speak to her. You should weep instead. You should pretend that you love someone else. You should write sonnets in three parts. Your perfect girl should die. Amanda's mother said, you have your whole life ahead of you. She fell asleep on the couch waiting for Nathaniel's father to come home. When she woke up, she saw him kneeling in front of her. She said, what's wrong? He said, nothing's wrong. I'm sorry. I didn't want to wake you. But he did wake her. She went home and stayed awake all night. Let's go somewhere, she told Nathaniel the next day. Where? Far away. They took the tea to Ashmont at the end of the red line. They sat together in the rattling car and talked about donuts. I like cinnamon donuts, but they make me cough, Nathaniel said. She slept lightly. She dreamed she was walking with Nathaniel in a pine forest. She was telling him not to step on the dead hummingbirds. The birds were sapphire-throated, brilliant blue. She stole La Vita Nuova. It was just a paperback. Her sister called to check in. Her friend Jamie said she knew someone she'd like Amanda to meet. Amanda said, soon. Jamie said, what exactly are you waiting for? Nathaniel's father pretended not to look at her. Amanda pretended not to notice his dark eyes. The question is what you're going to do in September, Amanda's mother told her on the phone. The question is what you're going to do with your life, her father said. Dante wrote, O you who on the road of love pass by, attend and see, if any grief there be as heavy as mine. When was the last time you painted anything, her mother asked, apart from your apartment? Her father said, I paid for Yale. All day Amanda and Nathaniel studied the red ants of Buckingham Street. They experimented with cake crumbs and observed the ants change course to eat them. Nathaniel considered becoming an entomologist when he grew up. The next day he decided to open his own ice cream store. They hiked to Christina's in Inman Square. Nathaniel pedaled in front on his little bike. Amanda pedaled behind on her big bike and watched for cars. At Christina's, Nathaniel could read almost all the flavors on the board. Adzuki bean, black raspberry, burnt sugar, chocolate banana, chocolate orange, cardamom. Nathaniel said, I'll have vanilla. They sat in front near the bulletin board with ads for guitar lessons, tutoring, transcendental meditation. What's an egg donor? Nathaniel said. I want to be with you for the rest of my life, her fiancé had told her once. You are my best friend, he had written on her birthday card. You make me smile. You make me laugh. Love weeps, Dante wrote. Could I have a quarter for a gumball? Nathaniel asked Amanda. You just had ice cream, she said. Please? No, you just had ice cream. You don't need candy. Please, 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 he said. You're lovely, Nathaniel's father whispered to Amanda late that night. She was just leaving, and he'd opened the door for her. You're not supposed to say that, Amanda whispered back. You're supposed to write a sonnet. Nathaniel said that he knew what to do when you were upset. She said, tell me, Nathaniel. He said, go to the zoo. Nathaniel studied the train schedule. They took the orange line to Ruggles Station and then the number 22 bus to the Franklin Park Zoo. They watched orangutans sitting on their haunches, shredding newspapers one page at a time. They climbed up on viewing platforms to observe the giraffes. They ran down every path. They looked at snakes. They went to the little barnyard and a goat frightened Nathaniel. Amanda said the goat was just curious. She said, goats wouldn't eat you. Nathaniel fell asleep on the tee on the way home. He leaned against Amanda and closed his eyes. The woman sitting next to Amanda said, he's beautiful. Amanda's friend Jamie had a party in Somerville. The wine was terrible. The friend that Jamie wanted Amanda to meet was drunk. Amanda got drunk, too, but it didn't help. She was late to work the next day. She found Nathaniel waiting on his mother's porch. I thought you were sick, he said. I was, she told him. They walked to Harvard Square and watched the street magicians. They went to Lee's and shared vegetarian summer rolls and Thai iced tea. "This tastes like orange chalk," Nathaniel said. They went to a store called Little Russia and looked at the lacquered dolls there. "See, they come apart," Amanda told Nathaniel. "You pop open this lady, and inside there's another and another and another." "Do not touch, please," the sales lady told them. They walked down to the river and sat on the grass under a tree and talked about their favorite dogs. "Labradoodle," Amanda said. Nathaniel giggled. "No, Schnoodle. Golden Strudel." Nathaniel said, "Is that the kind you had when you were young?" She dreamed that she was a Russian doll. Inside her was a smaller version of herself, and inside that an even smaller version. She ordered a set of blank wooden dolls online and began painting them. She covered the dolls with white primer. Then she painted them with acrylics and her finest brushes. First, a toddler only an inch high in a gingham bathing suit. Second, a fingerling schoolgirl wearing glasses. Third, an art student with a portfolio under her arm. Fourth, a bride in white with long flowing hair. Fifth, a babysitter in sandals and sundress. She painted Nathaniel standing in front of her in his gecko t-shirt and blue shorts. He stood waist high with her painted hands on his shoulders. When the paint was dry, she covered each doll with clear gloss. After that coat dried, she glossed each doll again until the reds were as bright as candy apples, the blues sparkled, and every color looked good enough to eat. She bought another set of blanks and began all over. She stayed up late each night painting. "Why are you so sleepy?" Nathaniel asked her in the afternoons. In the mornings, his mother asked her, "Why are you always late?" She fell asleep with Nathaniel at 8 o'clock. She curled up next to him in his captain's bed and woke when his father came in and touched her cheek. "I was wondering if you could come to the Cape with us," Nathaniel's father said as they tiptoed out into the hall. She shook her head. "Just for a few days in August." His voice was low. His eyes were almost pleading. "You are so beautiful," her fiancé had said. She painted Nathaniel's father on a set of Russian dolls. First, she painted a toddler in a romper. Second, she painted a boy in a little Catholic school uniform with short pants and a tie. Third, she painted a bridegroom, dashing in a dark suit with white stephanotis for his boutonniere. Fourth, she painted a new father with a baby Nathaniel in his arms. Fifth, she painted a gray-haired man in reading glasses. She painted Nathaniel's father older than he was and stouter. Not handsome as he was in real life, but grandfatherly, with the belly following the contours of the bell-shaped doll. As before, she coated each painted doll with clear gloss until the colors gleamed. As before, she made each doll a perfect jewel-like object, but she spent the most time on the biggest, oldest doll. After that, she bought more blanks and painted more sets. People she knew, people she didn't know, people she met. Portraits in series, 5 dolls each. She painted Patsy blonder and blonder in each incarnation. She painted her fiancé as a boy, as an athlete, as a law student, as a paunchy bald guy, as a decrepit old man. She didn't kill him, but she aged him. She lined up the dolls and photographed them. She thought about fellowships. She imagined group shows, solo shows, refusing interviews. She took Nathaniel to swimming lessons. She went down to the harbor with him, and they threw popcorn to seagulls that caught the kernels in mid-air. Nathaniel had his 7th birthday party on Castle Island. He and his friends built a walled city of sandcastles with a moat. Nathaniel was the architect. Amanda was his assistant. His father was a photographer. His mother served the cake. At the end of the party, Amanda gathered the presents. Nathaniel was leaving for the Cape with his father, and then his mother was going to take him to the vineyard for Labor Day weekend. Nathaniel said, "When we come back, it will be September." She said, "You're right." He said, "Could you come with me?" Amanda said, "I can't. I'm painting my apartment." He said, "What color?" She said, "Actually, I'm moving." "Moving away?" She told him, "You can talk to me on the phone." Nathaniel started to cry. His mother said, "Honey!" He held on to Amanda and cried, "Why can't you be my babysitter anymore?" "I'm going to New York," she said. "Why?" "Because your mother doesn't like me," she told him silently. "Because your father wants to sleep with me. because the only reason I came to Boston was my fiancé, because the question is what I'm going to do with my life. But all she said aloud was, "That's where I'm from." She knelt down and gave him a map she'd drawn. She'd singed the edges of the parchment to make it look old. The map showed the cave at the source of the Charles River, the swan boats flying away, the chocolate mice at Burdick's, Christina's ice cream, Ashmont, the cemetery with dragon's teeth. Nathaniel's mother said, "This is gorgeous." Nathaniel's father said, "You're really very talented." Nathaniel said he didn't want a map. He said that he would rip it up. His mother said, "Nathaniel, is that any way to treat a gift?" His father said, "Come here." Nathaniel tore a big piece out of the map. He screamed at his parents, "I don't want you!" "He's tired," Nathaniel's mother told Amanda. "He's exhausted. Too much excitement in one day." "I'm not tired," Nathaniel screamed, and he wouldn't let go of Amanda. He held on to her, half strangling her with his arms around her neck. "Look, Nathaniel," his father began. His mother interrupted, "You're making it worse." Nathaniel was crying harder. He cried with his whole body. No one could get him to stop. Amanda closed her eyes. She said she was sorry. She said, "Please stop." Finally, she rocked him in her arms and said, "I know, I know." And that was La Vita Nuova by Allegra Goodman from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. The Hatchet Man in the Lighthouse by William Peden. We are sitting on the trunk of a fallen palmetto pine, Miss Peaches and I, waiting for the sun to set. Far down the beach, where a curving strand and sky merge, we can glimpse the pale blue-pink smudge that is Savannah. Below us, a few vacationers still linger on the sand, but to the east, the shore is deserted. It is almost time to go home to dinner. The moon has not yet risen. The tide is coming in. Out of nowhere, a boy jogs toward us. He's neither city pale nor tidewater tan. He looks to be between 6 and 7 years old. A few yards from us, he slows down, hesitates, finally stops in front of Miss Peaches. "Hi," she says, and smiles. So do I. "Hello," he replies, somewhat formally. "A city boy, from Savannah, perhaps, maybe Beaufort." He's a fine-looking youngster, well-formed and with clear blue eyes. "Been swimming?" I ask, a foolish question. His hair is wet, soaking wet. "How was the water?" "Yes," he says, and scratches in the sand with his toes. "It was good." Miss Peaches nods agreement. "We've been in twice today. The surf was wonderful, just right." The boy starts to say something, hesitates, and points across the shining sea toward the mainland. "I've been there, too," he announces. "Have you?" We nod. The boy squints and points again. "Do you see it?" "See what?" I ask, squinting in turn. "The lighthouse." His voice is mildly patronizing. "Way down there, the lighthouse." "There's no lighthouse there," I start to say, but Miss Peaches interrupts. "Yes," she tells the boy, "we see it." "Have you ever been there?" "No," I say. "No, we've never been there." "I have." His voice is firm. It brooks no disagreement. "My mom and dad took me there." "Did they?" Miss Peaches asks. "What fun it must have been. What's the lighthouse like?" He hesitates. "It's big," he says after a pause. "It's very big." "Is it?" I say. "How big?" He looks through me and beyond me, eyes narrowed, scanning the horizon. "It's big enough for him." "For him?" Miss Peaches and I speak in unison, as though the scene had been rehearsed. "The hatchet man." His voice is very serious, very earnest. "A giant hatchet man." "The hatchet man," I say. "I never knew. I mean, what's he like, this hatchet man?" The boy's clear blue eyes travel from mine. He is seeing something I cannot see. "He's huge," he gestures with both hands. He's gargantuan." "Is he?" I suppress a smile, shake my head, and glance toward Miss Peaches. The boy nods emphatically. "There are seahorses out there, too." He extends his arms, embracing the entire expanse of land and slowly darkening sea. "Man-sized seahorses." "Yes," Miss Peaches says. "We've seen them. but we've never seen the hatchet man. What does he do there? What's he like? Again, the boy scratches the sand with his toes. He's very ugly, he says after a long, thoughtful pause. He's as ugly as sin. He hesitates while I bite my lip to suppress a smile. But he's very, very kind. Kind, I say. That's good to know. I'm glad to know that he's kind. But why? Why do you call him the hatchet man? He looks at me with diminishing patience. Because that's who he is. Everybody. He slowly shakes his head as if in disbelief. Almost everybody knows that. Toward Savannah, the blue-pink smudge has turned the color of smoke, but in the east a faint glimmer illuminates the water. Soon the moon will be rising. There's a slight offshore breeze, but there may be some mosquitoes. It is time for us to go back to the house. I extend my hand toward the boy. It's very interesting, all these things. Perhaps we'll see you again tomorrow, and you can tell us more about him. We'd like to hear more about the hatchet man, and the seahorses, too. He shakes my hand. He no longer seems irritated at my stupidity. I'll come back, he says. I'll come back tomorrow morning. Be sure to, Miss Peaches says. We want to hear more about them. She leans over and runs her hand lightly through his damp hair. He smiles, heads toward the hard-packed sand at the edge of the sea, and turns and waves to us. We wave back. My mom, he calls, his voice clear and distinct. My mom's dead. She died yesterday. We say nothing as he turns again and jogs off, well-coordinated, light on his feet. He will become a good middle-distance runner. Miss Peaches and I watch him without speaking till he's only a speck in the distance. I think he stops once to wave, but at that distance and without my glasses, I cannot be sure. And that story was The Hatchet Man in the Lighthouse by William Peden from Sudden Fiction American Short Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.